day to you and welcome to Shepherd's Chapel. We have a very special program indeed for you today. At this time, it's my pleasure to introduce to you a biblical archaeologist and historian. This gentleman that we're honored to have with us today holds a Master of Arts degree in biblical archaeology and history. He's a member of the Archaeology Institute of America. In 1972, he was elected as a fellow to the Society of Antiquaries of Scotland, and in 1976, he was honored with an honorary doctorate degree in literature. And at this time, it's my privilege to introduce to you Mr. E. Raymond Capp. Mr. Capp, I want to tell you how much of a pleasure it is to meet with you and work with you on this project. We thank you for taking time from your busy schedule to be with us today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. I had a chance to show somebody else my work.
And could you tell us a little bit more about the stone and the significance of it?
That's when he had the dream of a ladder going to heaven, seen angels going up and down, and saw God at the top. And he woke in the morning. He was God made promises to him, covenant. He more or less was stunned by what he heard. In the morning, he poured oil on the stone and anointed it. And said, this is now God's house. So, anointed stone, and of course, the book will tell you about that stone. He left it there for a while. But later on, he was told to go back and pick up the stone, and he carried it with him and put another stone up in his place. And many believe that stone is the one that's under the coronation chair in Westminster Abbey.
Mm-hmm.
And all the kings and the of Ireland had been crowned on that stone. The stone was later taken to Scotland by Fergus the Great, and all the kings of Scotland were crowned on that stone. And later it was taken by the English to England and put in Westminster Abbey.
Uh-huh.
But the kings of England were all crowned on that. There's only one monarch who was not crowned on the stone. That's Queen Mary, Bloody Mary. The Roman Catholics made the church made her a private throne, but she's the only one that wasn't crowned on it.
I see. The stone is also known as some by some as I think the stone. Some people pronounce it scone, but I think the correct pronunciation is scone.
Scone,
yes. Mm-hmm. The stone of scone.
In the first half of the 6th century BC, at a city of ancient Egypt called Tephanis, a wedding took place. The bride was a princess of the royal house of Judah, and the groom was a soldier in the pay of Egypt, a prince of the Milesians, a people from the eastern Mediterranean. Men who were fighters, colonizers, traders, venturing by sea and land all over the then known world. If we ask ourselves what was the significance of this wedding all those years ago, we have to go forward in time, forward some 2,500 years to this, the Royal Abbey of Westminster in London, the Royal Peculiar, where stands the coronation chair and the coronation stone on which for centuries have been crowned the sovereigns of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland. But for this story, we also have to go back in time, back to a day recorded in the Old Testament, when Jacob, blessed as the heir of Isaac and fleeing from the land of Canaan and from the anger of his elder brother Esau, stopped in the open to sleep, making use of a stone for his pillow. And there dreamed a dream which filled him with awe, a dream in which he saw a stairway up to heaven, with angels ascending and descending. The dream of Jacob's ladder, and at the head, God himself. When he awoke in the morning, stunned by his experience, he anointed with oil the stone he had used as a headrest, and called the place Bethel, the house of God, so that the stone became the stone of Bethel, the stone of destiny. and thy seed shall be as the dust of the earth. And thou shalt spread abroad, to the west, and to the east, and to the north, and to the south. And in thee and in thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. An anointed stone, the enduring witness to God's covenant with man. This stone which I have set for a pillar shall be God's house. So Jacob went on his way from Bethel, from Canaan, northwards to his ancestral lands in Haran, to the home of his uncle Laban. There he settled, met and married two wives, Leah and Rachel, and raised a family of 12 sons and a daughter. But he still looked on Canaan as his real home, and at last he and his folk set out to return to Canaan. But on the way, an angel of God came to wrestle with him, and they fought, and Jacob won. And so God gave to him the name of Israel, one who prevailed with God. No longer Jacob the supplanter, but Israel, a prince with God. So it was that as Jacob and his family came back to Canaan, he made his way to that same spot where he had dreamed of his God. And there, God reaffirmed his covenant with him. In thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. But if Canaan was to be his home for most of his life, Jacob was destined not to die there. Away to the southwest, across the Sinai Desert, lay the land of Egypt. To this land, Jacob's favorite son Joseph had been sold by his jealous brothers to be a slave. The story of how Joseph rose to a position of power in the land, of how his foresight made Egypt a land of plenty, of how his brothers came to Egypt to buy grain at a time of famine, and of how Joseph urged them to bring their families and their now aged father Jacob to Egypt. This story is well known. So the children of Israel uprooted themselves from the land of Canaan and trekked across the desert to the land of Goshen in Egypt. And among their possessions, would not the sacred stone of Bethel have come too? There in the land of Goshen, Jacob, reunited with his favorite son, lived for a further 15 years. But now he was an old man, ill and nearing death. So, as the custom was, he made arrangements to bestow his family blessings on his sons. First he called Joseph, and to him, the son who had saved his people, Jacob gave the firstborn's portion and the keeping of the stone of Israel. And when he came to bless the sons of Joseph as his heirs, he crossed his arms, so that his right hand touched the younger, Ephraim. From thence is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. Two centuries later, the situation of the Israelites in Egypt was very different. For a new dynasty of pharaohs had arisen, who knew not Joseph and his people. Oppressed, at last they rose up under Moses and fled from Egypt across the waters of the Red Sea. This is the actual spot, hallowed in Bedouin legend, where the waters of the Red Sea parted to let them cross, but came together to engulf the pursuing Egyptians. So they came into the Sinai Desert and southwards towards Mount Sinai. There, where the coastal deserts rise towards the mountains, at Mount Sinai, Moses received from God the laws which were to give them a national identity under the one God, Jehovah. Two tablets of engraved stone, henceforth preserved in that most holy of holies, the Ark of the Covenant. Wherever the people of Israel went, the Ark of the Covenant went with them. And the stone of Bethel, did not that go too? Or was it not the first of the covenant witness stones? The covenant stone of Jacob, father of Israel, patriarch of the 12 tribes. 40 years the stone shared their wanderings in the desert. where the miracles of the manna from heaven and the water from the rock sustained them. St. Paul was to understand their meaning.
Brethren, I would not that ye should be ignorant how that all our fathers did eat the same spiritual meat, and did all drink the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that went with them, and that rock was the anointing.
Moses, his work done, was to die in the desert, but not before he had sighted the promised land. Joshua completed the reoccupation of Canaan. The 12 tribes settled, albeit uneasily, into their captured territories. At Hebron, they buried the bones of Joseph with those of his father Jacob in a plot of land that Abraham had bought from Ephron the Hittite. And at Shechem, setting up the stone as a witness, they renewed the covenant at the spot traditionally marked today by this memorial stone. Now we must let time slip away. Almost 500 years. Years in which the loose tribal federation, beset by enemies, had in its own protection to become a single unified kingdom under warrior monarchs. Saul, David, Solomon the Wise. These were years in which the nation became powerful, prosperous, and wealthy. Years in which the tabernacle was moved to a new religious capital, Jerusalem. Then came years in which a decline set in which the kingdom split in two, so that the 10 tribes of the north became one kingdom, taking the name of Israel, with Bethel as its sanctuary and Samaria as its capital, while the tribes to the south formed a southern kingdom, Judah keeping both sanctuary and capital at Jerusalem. Then, finally, years in which disaster struck. First, in the complete elimination of the northern kingdom by the Assyrians, and the deportation of the people to become the 10 last tribes of Israel. Then, as a final blow, the conquest by the Babylonians in 587 BC of the kingdom of Judah, the capture of the king, Zedekiah, the slaughter of his sons, and the deportation of most of the people to Babylon.
How doth the city sit solitary that was full of people? How has she become as a widow, she that was great among nations?
Thus wailed Jeremiah.
But Johanan, the son of Kareah, took all the remnant of Judah, men, women, and children, and Jeremiah the prophet, and the king's daughters. So they came into the land of Egypt.
Not only did the party come to Egypt, we even know exactly where they went. To Tophanes. Tophanes, the Daphne of the Greek historian Herodotus, was in those days a major garrison and commercial center on the Pelusian arm of the Nile. Today, it is a barren mound like this, called Tel El Daphne, where the fortress, excavated by Sir Flinders Petrie, must have looked like this. The ruins are still known by the locals as Casa El Bint Yehudi, the palace of the Jew's daughter.
And the king's daughters.
Under Israel law, inheritance can come equally from the female line. So these little princesses were destined to carry into the future the continuity of the royal line of David, king of Israel. Did not Jeremiah, salvaging what he could from the wreck of his nation, take with him to Tophanes all that was left of the succession of Israel? The rotten little princesses, and a stone left from the destruction of Jerusalem. The stone of Bethel, the stone of destiny. Here at Tophanes, in the early 6th century BC, the little party disappear from recorded history, but not, as we are about to see, from legend. For now, our story takes us from Egypt to another land, to an island on the edge of the then known world. Remote it may seem from the lands of the Mediterranean, but was it as remote as we might imagine? Let's make our way to a windswept hillcrest in County Meath, to Tamar Nari, Tara of the Kings, one of the most hallowed spots in ancient Irish history. Today, it
it is a proliferation of prehistoric mounds and pitches, just as in such profusion that the imagination is stirred to a sense of the timeless sanctity of the spot. Each feature has a modern name chosen from the deep well of Celtic legend. But the secrets of each feature's true identity remain hidden, and they date from many different periods of prehistory. Thus, the tumulus, called the Mound of the Hostages, is in fact a passage grave, a tomb with a central burial chamber connected to the exterior by a tunnel or passage, and dating from several millennia B.C. But, and this is the interesting fact, similar graves are found in Iberia, modern Spain. Moreover, there were found in this tomb beads of Mediterranean manufacture placed there by Bronze Age men. So here, thousands of years ago, is evidence of close cultural and trade links between Ireland and the Mediterranean. Even more impressive is the similar grave at Newgrange, near Drogheda, in County Meath, 280 feet in diameter, with a superb tomb entrance now restored. In front of the entrance, a later people decorated one of the stones, and the prehistoric markings they carved are those the Mycenaeans used on their tombs in Asia Minor. And the Mycenaeans are a Mediterranean people, called also Ionians, called also Milesians, men of the Scythian race who appeared in history from the lands to which the 10 lost tribes of Israel were deported. Moreover, many times in Ireland have been uncovered hoards of ancient gold, gold ornaments fashioned from Irish gold by Celtic craftsmen, to a pattern based on the mid-European culture of Latane and Hallstatt, and traded all over the known world. Examples like these, made in Ireland, have been excavated from Gaza itself in Israel. Celtic gold in Israel, decorated stones of Drogheda with Milesian carving, passage tombs of Tara whose designs originate in Spain. These are facts of archaeology quite unknown to the tellers of Ireland's ancient history. All the more exciting, therefore, that they breathe truth and colour into those early legends which link the ancestors of the first kings of Ireland with two princes, Heba and Hereman, who were the sons of Scota, a princess of Judah in Egypt. May not these legends enshrine ancient folk memories of the wedding of one of the princesses of Judah, whom Jeremiah brought to Egypt? Was she not Scota, who, at Tophanes, married Neil, her Milesian prince? The historian Herodotus tells us that the Milesian mercenaries moved on from Egypt to other Milesian colonies. Many of these are known to have been on the coast of Spain. And did not Scota and her husband travel there, taking with them the sacred relics of their people? Later, when her two sons, Heba and Hereman, left Spain to found royal dynasties in Ireland, would they not too have taken with them the sacred relics of their mother's people? And would not the Stone of Destiny have been among them? It is interesting to see what account of their arrival we glean from the legends of ancient Ireland. We learn that there arrived, some centuries before the birth of Christ, a people known as to our today, the people of God, who were one of the families of the Milesians, the people of Hereman and Heba. Moreover, they took to Tara a number of their sacred objects, among which was a stone they venerated as the Lea Foil, the Stone of Destiny. There is a stone called the Lea Foil at Tara today, but the identification is no more authentic than those other names which supposedly identify the antiquities of Tara. The true Lea Foil did indeed rest at Tara, and on it were crowned for nearly 1,000 years the royal descendants of Hereman and Heba. But the stone did not remain there. To discover what happened to it, let's look towards the most recent feature built at Tara, the banqueting hall. Once a vast arcaded hall 750 feet long, here were summoned to council by the high kings of Ireland, all the lesser kings and chieftains. And here, about the year 500 AD, approval would have been given for the Leofoil to be sent to one of the royal princes, Fergus More MacCaoch, who was to be king of all the men from Ireland, who had in the intervening years crossed the water and settled in the islands and coastal fringes of the west coast of Caledonia. So, from Tara, the stone was carried northwards, past the great stone chair at Slievna Culla, on which prehistoric markings exist, which in age and pattern match those on the stones of the mound of the hostages at Tara. And so across the cornfields of Meath, through the richest pasture land in Europe, towards the narrow neck of water that separates Ireland from Scotland. Here, at the little port of Dunseverick, on the north coast of Ireland, the stone would have been hoisted aboard ship. Its destination was an island off the coast of Caledonia, the island of St. Columba, the Isle of Iona. There, in the early 6th century AD, Fergus More MacCaoch was crowned the first king in Caledonia of the line of Helm. The visitor should tread softly here, for on this island of Iona, long before St. Augustine brought to Britain the tenets of the Roman Church, the spirit of Christianity flowered. And here came for their coronations not only kings of Scotland, but also of Ireland, and even of Norway. And when their reign was over, many of them were brought back to Iona. And here they remain, with the silent witness of the Celtic crosses to mark their faith. As the Scots extended their sway to the mainland, the stone was taken to Dunstaffnage, and there it was to remain while the Scots kingdom widened to embrace the whole of Caledonia. Then, in 846 AD, King Kenneth II, the first king of the United Kingdom of the Picts and Scots, had the stone transported to a little hill at Scone in Perthshire. And here, for the next 450 years, the later kings of Scotland were crowned, the stone forming an essential part of the ceremony. William de Richanger describes the last of these Scots coronations, about 1250 AD. John de Balliol, on the following feast of St. Andrew, and seated upon the regal stone which Jacob placed under his head when he went from Beersheba to Haran, was solemnly crowned in the church of the canons regular at Scone. In 1296, at the Battle of Dunbar, the Scots became subject to Edward I of England. They continued to protest their independence, and 30 years later, in the Declaration of Arbroath, Robert the Bruce justified Scots' independence to the world, arguing that their line of kings was part of Milesian and Scythian dynasty of 113 kings in unbroken succession from the sons of Heber and Hadamon. But the English were deaf to these proclamations. The regalia of the Scots kings, the honours of Scotland, had already been taken by King Edward to London, to Westminster Abbey. And there his painter, Master Walter of Durham, enclosed the stone in a wooden chair for the sum of 100 crowns. It is still there today, nearly 700 years later, although the honours of Scotland have long ago been returned. On this historic block of sandstone, the monarchs of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland have been crowned from time immemorial. On Christmas Eve 1950, the stone was removed from under the chair and abstracted from the abbey. It turned up, of course, in Scotland, on the altar stone of Arbroath Abbey, and was later, at the special request of King George VI, brought back to Westminster. During the removal, the stone was found to be broken, and here are some tiny chippings taken during repair. Geological experts have been asked to compare these chippings with samples taken, unbeknown to them, from one of the beds of sandstone which outcrop among the limestone near Bethel. Here is their microscope analysis. First, sandstone from the coronation stone. And now, sandstone from Bethel. And the verdict? It is possible that the specimens could have been closely related both in space and time. Coronation stone. Bethel. An interesting verdict indeed. present owner of the land at Scone in Scotland commemorates the link by breeding four-horned sheep. Sheep of a breed so ancient that they would have been familiar to Abraham and Isaac. Jacob's sheep. 4,000 years ago, Jacob, father of his people Israel, laid his head on a stone and dreamed a dream in which God told him that in his seed would all the nations of the earth be blessed. The evidence of legend, tradition, and history suggests that there may well be a direct line of descent to the British royal family of the day. For Her Majesty the Queen is descended from James I of England, who was James VI of Scotland, a descendant of the Scots kings buried on Iona, an unbroken line of descent from Fergus More MacArthur, who was, as a descendant of the High Kings of Ireland at Tara, himself of the royal line of Harriman, son of that Scoter who, as a young princess, was married to the Milesian prince Neil in Egypt. Herself, one of the princesses of Judah, who came with the prophet Jeremiah to Tophani after the destruction of Jerusalem. And was not Jacob her ancestor? And was she not of the royal line of David? The evidence of legend, tradition, and history suggests that the stone which today rests in Westminster Abbey as part of the coronation chair could well be that stone which Jacob anointed at Bethel 4,000 years ago. A stone hallowed by 4,000 years of history, priceless in its silent witness of God's everlasting covenant with his people Israel. The stone of Bethel. The stone of fate. The stone of destiny. In thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed.
Half as old as time.
How did it come by that name?
A fellow Burgeon, he wrote that poem. He talked about that.
I see.
The Petra was one of the most fascinating places. Mount Seir is where Petra is. It's the most cursed city in the Bible. Only one time, cursed. In fact, the curse is so strong, it said, "Thy city shall not return."
Red City of Petra is situated some 150 miles south of Amman in Transjordan, which is about halfway between the Gulf of Aqaba and the Dead Sea. Our journey to Petra is going to start from Aqaba. We came here by boat from Cairo by way of the Red Sea. Many tourists come here to visit the beach resort city of Eilat to escape the heat of the summer. From Eilat, we hire a jeep to drive us to Petra. We drive some 80 miles north on a paved highway before turning west onto a dirt road leading toward the granite mountains of the Sinai Peninsula. At first, the landscape is quite flat, leveled by flash floods that rush down from the rocky slopes during the short but violent rainy season. Soon, we reach the base of the mountains of Edom, and after 2 hours of driving, it is good to get out, stretch, and enjoy the view of the rugged crags, once the home of the Edomites, the descendants of Esau, from whom the mountains get its name. Hey, our jeep is leaving us. Don't worry, it's all in fun. Our driver will be back. At times, the roads seem to just disappear. I asked the driver, how did he know where the road was? He didn't. He just followed the tracks made by whoever had been there before. The ancient caravans that once carried trade goods from Egypt to Damascus in the north had to traverse this desert wasteland where water was scarce and shelter from the sandstorms lacking. It was because of this that Petra became a major camel caravan stopover, having a bountiful supply of water, shelter, and most important, protection from bandits. We are following the major trade route for goods moving north and south, known as the King's Highway, a route that passes through Petra. For the protection of the caravans, the Nabataeans established fort-like settlements, usually about a day's journey apart. We'll stop and visit the ruins of one such fort, found sheltered by these cliffs. The Nabataeans migrated from Arabia into the Edomite kingdom in the 6th century B.C. And for a time, the two peoples lived side by side. Within a few centuries, however, the Nabataeans became the dominant force, many Edomites integrating into the Nabataean society, while others moved into Palestine to occupy the cities vacated by the Judeans when they were carried away into Babylonian captivity. The Nabataeans made Petra their fortress capital and were able to withstand several invasions by nations jealous of their power and wealth, accumulated from the taxation of the trade passing through their land. An army sent by Alexander the Great was unsuccessful in capturing Petra, as was an expeditionary force sent by Rome. However, in AD 106, the Nabataeans lost their independence and became a Roman province. The ruins we are viewing now were probably built during the Roman period, as evidenced by the use of Roman-style limestone columns decorating the buildings. Water from the settlement came from a spring high up in the mountains that flowed down a channel dug to the town. The size of the town cemetery adjoining the ruins must have been an important settlement. Close by the ruins is a little Arab village that uses the same water supply by conveying the water by means of a modern metal pipe to the village community watering tank to supply man and beast alike. Animal breeding is the main source of livelihood for the present-day Bedouins. They raise goats that provide milk, meat, and skins for their tents, horses and donkeys and camels for transportation. But the camel is by far the most important animal because after it gets this full of water, it can go days at a time with no additional supply. Also, a camel manages to find fodder where seemingly no vegetation exists. Camels are also used for milk on long journeys in the desert, even to substitute for water for the horses. The Bedouin call their country the mother of the camel. Arabian camels have but one hump, and it is called the dromedary, which is the Greek word for camel that runs. The two-humped breed is slow and used only as a beast of burden in Central Asia and the Gobi Desert. A camel can actually go 5 days without water. That is, after it has been filled up, which takes about 20 gallons and a half hour to do so. There are, however, two problems with a camel. They can bite when they have the urge to, and they have a mind of their own. Whoops, there goes one right now, not waiting for his master. Realizing the difficulty of living on this desert without the camels, the Arabs have become tolerant of such independence. The Jordanian army maintains a post of 14 soldiers of its famous camel corps near the village. These men are well trained and hardened to desert life, and they must be able to mount a running camel while holding a gun in one hand. Their camels also are well trained. They can trot at 21 miles an hour, canter at 28, and gallop up to 32. For a whole day's travel, the most desirable speed is a jog trot of about 7 miles per hour. 50 miles in one day is no hard feat. We still have some distance to travel before reaching Petra, our destination. The landscape becomes more mountainous as we penetrate deeper into the mountains of Edom. For over 1,000 years, the Western world did not know where the city of Petra was located. only a few better than you, and they considered the city cursed and would not go near it nor talk about it. It was only in 1812, a time when a Western infidel would have been killed on sight, that John Burkhart, disguised as an Arab and fluent in Arabic language and customs, discovered the long-lost city. He was the first Westerner in over 1,000 years to lay eyes upon the monuments of Petra. As we get closer to Petra, we meet from time to time Arabs coming from somewhere and going to someplace, always with their camels or horses. The Bedouin today are very friendly, and their hospitality is legend. Although mostly Muslims, they are tolerant of Christianity. They say we are one in belief, that there is but one God, and He is supreme, and we should live together as brothers, a belief not always shared by other Muslims in other parts of the world. We make a short stop at the little Arab village of Elhai to fill our water cans at the Spring of Moses, so named because tradition has this as the site where Moses struck the rock long centuries ago and water came forth. The inhabitants of the village come here daily, as did their ancestors for centuries, to fill their water bags and now modern jeep cans left from military activity during the last major war. Their ancestors, of course, used only animal skins and pottery jugs. This spring is the only source of water for the village and for the Arabs that live for miles around in the surrounding desert. From Elhai, we make preparations to replace our jeep with horses to continue our way to Petra. The Arabs offer camels or horses, but the wise traveler will choose a horse. It's much easier to ride than a camel. And remember what I said about a camel? They can bite when they feel the urge. Soon we are mounted and on our way. The trail to Petra is probably the same one used by the ancient camel caravans that once brought trade and wealth to the Nabataeans. In fact, four ancient trade routes converge on Petra. The predominant colors of the mountains of Edom are variations of red, which is the meaning of the name Edom. It was in these red mountains of Edom that the descendants of Esau established the nation that became powerful enough to resist the children of Israel from passing through their land when coming out of Egypt. As we continue toward Petra, we see evidences of the ancient kingdom of Edom, carved stone tombs, cave-like homes that once provided shelter for the ancient inhabitants of Petra. Finally, we come to the first of Petra's major monuments, the obelisk tomb, so named for the obelisk carved in the front. However, this is only the suburbs of Petra, so to speak. We have to continue a little further to get to Petra proper. As we ride on, we see more and more carved tombs and homes in the cliffs, some hidden away in shaded recesses in canyon walls. The path passes by an old Roman dam built to divert floodwaters from washing down the only entrance to Petra, which has happened on several occasions, drowning those caught in the entrance. This is the only entrance to Petra, known as the Sikh. It was formed by floodwaters over the centuries, rushing down from the mountains above, following an earth fault. This defile is from 10 to 30 feet wide, with side walls over 300 feet in height. The pathway winds through the Sikh for nearly a mile. It widens and narrows many times. The overhanging cliffs on either side shut out the skyline, making it appear that night has fallen. In some places, only a ribbon of blue sky can be seen overhead. In several places, we ride over remnants of Roman paving stones still existing, providing evidence of the Roman occupation of Petra, which took place during the 2nd and 1st centuries AD. Through this narrow crack in the rock had passed the inhabitants of two great nations, the Edomites and the Nabataeans. Also many famous personages from classical, Rome, Greece, and Israel, and the Crusaders under Baldwin I in the 11th century A.D. As the sun makes its way across the sky, the towering walls of the Sikh change in colors. These colors range from pearly white to softest yellow and gold to red and carmine. In fact, every color of the rainbow is represented in the sandstones of Petra. These colorful sandstones of Petra remind one of the desert mountains of northeast Arizona and southwest Utah along the Grand Canyon. Carved in the side walls of the Sikh at irregular intervals are pagan religious shrines consisting of stone god blocks set into niches. These symbolize the god Duceres, one of the two Edomite chief deities. Traversing the Sikh gives one the eerie feeling they are exploring another planet. Just ahead of us is another stone god idol set in the walls of the Sikh. The Sikh is the only practical way to get into the city of Petra, unless you are a mountain goat. And you can see how difficult it would be to invade Petra, having to move an army through this narrow, mile-long ravine. Defenders stationed along the top of the cliffs could wreak havoc on any invading army by shooting arrows, spears, or just rock missiles down from the top of the cliffs. This was how Petra was successfully defended on several occasions. However, it was being a place of safety, having an abundance of water, it really was caused Petra to become an important city and wealthy by taxing the trade that passed through their area. It was the growing wealth that brought the Romans to Petra. They wanted to, well, muscle in for a percentage of the take, so to speak. Through intrigue rather than by fighting, they made a deal with the Nabataeans, who were then the masters of Petra. A partnership was formed that proved advantageous to both partners until ever-rising taxes on trade caused the caravans to bypass Petra, which in essence bankrupted the city. After riding for about 20 minutes, one reaches the narrowest and darkest part of the chasm. As they peer ahead in anticipation, they see there, standing out from the farthest wall of the transverse gorge, flooded by the morning's soft light, part of a beautiful cut cameo of immense proportions, set off and framed by the rugged cliffs on either side. And even though one is watching for this first glance, the scene bursts upon them as a surprise. A first-time visitor usually stops spellbound, struck by the magnificent contrast. Before riding on toward Petra's most famous monument, hidden for over 1,000 years in the mountains of Edom, the limpid pink stone building known as the Treasury, carved out of the native rock of Edom. It is actually the tomb of an ancient Nabataean king and was carved during the reign of the Roman Emperor Hadrian, who visited Petra in AD 131. The columns of this monument rise over 40 feet in height and about 130 feet above the ground level is an immense stone urn carved out of the red rose sandstone in a classic Greek style. The treasury is by far the most majestic and most elaborately carved of all the rock monuments of this ancient necropolis. The central chamber is 40 feet square, with flanking doorways leading to small rooms on both sides. These smaller rooms contain burial receptacles. Looking back from the vestibule of the treasury toward the Sikh, it is easy to see how a small number of defenders could hold off an army, which was the case when Alexander the Great sent an army that failed to force an entrance. This view shows how the temple was chiseled right out of the solid rock, which continues for several hundred feet above the ground. The The Nabataeans also carved their homes right out of the sandstone cliffs. Literally, thousands of such homes have been found in Petra. In some places, they are in rows facing streets cut into the rock. Keep in mind, these homes and monuments are over 2,000 years old and existed for over 1,000 years prior to that. This is known as the Street of the Facades. Many styles of architecture is found on the monuments of Petra. The plainer fronts are mostly Nabataean, while the more ornate are of the Roman period, often carved over the original Nabataean buildings. Only a few artifacts, like this marble head, have been found in the excavations of Petra, mainly due to the fact that the city was not destroyed by war or earthquakes, but just slowly dwindled away, giving the inhabitants time to remove their possessions. The only still standing wall building in Petra is the ruins of the Temple of the Pharaoh's Daughter, a name whose origin is unknown. It is actually a temple for the Edomite god Dusaris, later adopted by the Nabataeans. It was built by the Romans as a public works project to show tolerance for the religion of the inhabitants of Petra. Many of the ancient tombs and temples of Petra are located high up on the mountains surrounding the city. To reach them, we must climb steep gorges and often sets of stone stairs. And in doing so, we pass many natural caves that were no doubt once the homes of the early Edomites, whose descendants became, for the most part, integrated with the Nabataeans. Many of the Edomites, however, migrated into Palestine during the Babylonian captivity of Judah and were still there when the Judeans were allowed to return to Palestine by Cyrus after the downfall of Babylon. These Edomites were later integrated into the new so-called Jewish state, which by the time of Christ was a multiracial nation. About 600 feet above the city is Ed-Dur. To construct this temple, the ancient masons had to strip away a mountainside to create a flat surface into which to carve. Ed-Dur's huge door is some 26 feet high and provides the only light reaching the interior, a single chamber 38 feet by 37 feet in size. The facade of this temple is about 154 feet in width and approximately 132 feet in height, and contains niches for a placed statuary long since removed. The unique feature of Ed-Dur is a huge stone urn weighing many tons on top of the monument. It has been carved from a separate piece of rock, and it is interesting to speculate how this colossal weight was handled and placed into position. From the top of the urn, we gain a panoramic view of Petra. But watch out, don't get too close to the edge. I don't want to lose anyone. From the city of Petra, there are many side canyons winding up the mountains surrounding the city. All have paths passing by hundreds of cave-like homes and monuments. In one of these cave homes, Esau hid out as a hunter, whose descendants were the subject of a prophecy recorded in the scriptures by the prophet Obadiah, which reads, "Thus saith the Lord God concerning Edom, though thou exalt thyself as an eagle, though set thy nests among the stars, thence will I bring thee down, saith the Lord." Those words were fulfilled when Amaziah, king of Judah, invaded Petra in 785 BC. He literally pulled down the inhabitants from their nest-like homes, leaving them empty and bare. This series of facades includes Petra's royal tombs. First on the right is the Silk Tomb, the center the Corinthian Tomb, on the left the Palace Tomb, which originally had three stories, the top of masonry, which is now falling into ruin. The Palace Tomb is pure Nabataean in design. It is one of the only seven monuments of the classic Nabataean period found at Petra. Riding on, we pass many similar buildings, spanning an architectural style many centuries. We are on our way now to visit the famous Erin Temple, known as the Monastery. The monastery differs from other large temples in Petra in that it has a masonry extension supported by two stories of arched vaults. The monastery gets its name from a Christian inscription found on one of its interior walls. The Bible speaks of high places of sacrifice relating to pagan religious rites. The finest example of just such a place is the one found in Petra. To reach Petra's high place, we must climb up another steep gorge, up several sets of stone stairs cut into the bedrock of the mountain. At times, the path is just a narrow ledge along vertical sides, almost overhanging cliffs, where one misstep could be fatal. One wonders if Petra's newspaper had a long obituary column. It is a long climb to Petra's high place, so in several places we find where the path had flattened out, they had widened it to provide a resting place for the pilgrims. In the Old Testament, high places were generally associated with places of elevation, constructed artificially and used for sacrifice, sometimes human. The prophets of the Old Testament continually warned the Israelites against heathen worship in these places. We finally reached the top of the mountain, which is known as Obelisk Ridge, so named after two large obelisks found there. The two obelisks stand about 20 feet high and are about 100 feet apart. They have been carved from the mountaintop by quarrying all the rocks from around them. Petra's high place consists of a large court sunk into the surface of the rock top of the mountain. In the center of the court is a raised offering table or altar. And surrounding the court are ledges and benches containing various sized altars. What rites this place once witnessed can only be conjectured. However, all the requirements of human sacrifice are found here. A central altar where a victim is laid, as certain rites were performed on his body, a tub-like basin where the body could be washed, a standard procedure. Another body-sized pit where the body could be cremated after sacrifice. And a most important element for sacrifice, an altar basin for the actual bloodletting, designed to catch the blood in containers. It has been said, seeing is believing, but it doesn't always seem to work. Some visiting Arab, after seeing Petra's high place, wrote this inscription in Arabic. There is no such place. Did he mean it is non-existent in his mind, or there's no place like this? From the high place, we overlook the rocky, rugged mountains of Edom that provided a natural protection for the city of Petra and concealed its ruins from the eyes of the Western world for centuries. Since there is no water supply on top of the mountain, water for the high place was supplied from cisterns carved into the bedrock to catch rainwater during the rainy season, to augment what had to be carried up in containers. In descending the mountain by means of a different route, we pass another interesting monument, a carved lion with his head turned sideways facing the traveler, through which protrudes a lead pipe carrying bay and water from a small spring above to refresh the thirsty pilgrims on their way to the high place. Even at this elevation, we come across many Nabataean homes carved into the sandstone cliffs. Some with interesting outdoor-indoor living rooms, having a magnificent view and natural air conditioning, cool on cool days and hot on hot days. Although the homes of the Nabataeans were naturally colorful, They often plastered and painted over the walls in vivid colors, usually bright reds, blues, and white. When the Romans came to Petra, they reorganized the city, laid out a main street paved with limestone, and constructed on both sides ornate temples, commercial buildings, baths, and retail shops. They also brought entertainment to the inhabitants of Petra in the form of a large amphitheater carved out of the natural bedrock in the distinctive Roman style. It seats between 4,000 to 5,000 persons. It has 33 rows of seats with three main aisles carved in a semicircle of rock around a floor 120 feet in diameter with stage, orchestra, and wings for the performers. What appears to be box seats in the rear are actually Nabatean tombs exposed when the seating capacity was increased. As the population of Petra increased, at one time, well over 250,000 persons. Today, silence prevails, where once the roaring crowds cheered their favorite gladiators. Petra's streets, once bustling with life, are empty. Its homes no longer echo with the laughter of children. Petra's springs are dried up to such an extent that its once fertile valleys are now desert. The rose-red treasury building, now bronze-orange as evening falls, stands empty and deserted. Caravans laden with the riches of the East no longer come and go through the thick. Now, as our visit to Petra comes to an end, we are reminded of the 35th chapter of Ezekiel, where God says, quote, "Thus saith the Lord God, behold, O Mount Seir, I am against thee, I will lay thy cities desolate, I will make Mount Seir most desolate, and cut off from it him that passeth out, and him that returneth. I will make thee perpetual desolations, and thy cities shall not return, and ye shall know that I am the Lord." Petra is proof that God is faithful to his word. Once he says a thing, it will come to pass. We can have faith in his word.